Session number 22498, Reel 4.
To haul Reel 4.
I sprinted pretty fast, as you can imagine, and I managed to sort of up a gear or two in the process. It's very discouraging to realise that you're being targeted by a light machine gun. Anyway, I got to Brian. I told him what I was going to do. He said he'd give me fire support. I managed to get back. I said to the leading platoon commander, a chap called Peter Wade, "Peter, there's your objective. We're going to attack in echelons of platoon. We got bags of fire. Get going." He did, but unfortunately not very far because I've spanned our position on his left flank. Sorry, on his right flank. Opened up, it enfilade fire, killed a few of his blokes, and he got shot in the leg. But he managed to throw a smoke grenade, which concealed our movement. And I just yelled, "A company, follow me." And we tore up onto the objective, and we were successful. We took it with about 25 dead and about 15, 16 prisoners. Well, in fact, that, of course, we had opened the door because we had taken the enemy's flank, and he had no real alternative then but to withdraw the forces in front of D Company, which eventually got took their objective. And during the night, the two reserve companies, B and C, passed through us and took the woods beyond. So we had a pretty successful time in the end, but we did lose a lot of casualties in that process.
And then the other action you mentioned?
It was about a fortnight later. It was called people either call it the Battle of the Ironhold Crossroads or the Battle of the River Lethe. And again, we were getting on towards Bremen. Cut for a moment. Okay. Again, we had only a single road on which to advance, and we were going towards Bremen, which was to the north. We had to cross the River Lethe, which was about 15 feet wide and had steep banks on either side. Needless to say, the Germans had blown the bridge. D Company were leading, and my company was following up. Behind me was battalion headquarters, and behind them were B and C companies, and I can't remember in which order. Anyway, Brian managed to get his infantry soldiers across and establish his three platoons in this area. Unfortunately, he couldn't get his tanks across. Now, while he was doing that, I decided I would explore down here, see if there was another crossing. And I found a ford just about there. That was about 100 yards to the
southeast.
100 yards away from the bridge. I managed to get my company across. I also managed to get my tanks across. So I was in business. I was then able to support Brian on the other side of the main road, which meant we had established a bridgehead. By this time, it was pretty late in the evening. And the commanding officer who had established his headquarters here and curled up the two reserve quarters, two reserve companies in the woods just to the south of the river. So we were in a fairly compact area around the bridge. The sappers were due to come forward during the night to repair the bridge, so that the road would then be open for a further advance on the following morning. Well, this had been a pretty busy day for all of us, actually. And at about 5 o'clock in the morning, there was a tremendous artillery barrage on our forward positions. Incidentally, the sappers hadn't been able to repair the bridge because artillery fire had been on the bridge all night, which had caused casualties both to equipment and to individuals. About 5 o'clock in the morning, there was this tremendous artillery fire on our forward positions, and we were attacked by what subsequently were proved to be over 600 infantry soldiers. Remember, there were probably about 200 of us over here at that time. And they also had two tanks, two Tiger tanks, supporting them. Well, we had a pretty hairy time. And our forward position troops got knocked out of their positions by the initial attack. And I came out of my headquarters, which was a building a little bit further down, and there were two tanks coming down, a fire break in the woods, and a lot of infantry about. And I had a hell of a time trying to resort the company, get them into positions and so on. And to cut a long story short, after a battle that went on for over 3 or 4 hours, we eventually managed to knock the whole thing back.
Can you give any details of what happened in those 3 or 4 hours?
Well, it was close quarter fighting in woods, which involved some pretty hairy things happening. It's very difficult to be more specific about that. I was extremely busy, really, sort of reciting people in positions and trying to get, trying to keep the sort of morale up.
Were you mostly with A Company or with D Company?
No, I was commanding A Company at that time. And in fact, that really was the last counterattack of the war that the Germans put in against the 43rd Division. And 2 days later, I was ordered to approve another route through woods to the flank of western flank of the woods that the road ran through, in case there was going to be a counterattack from that direction, whilst the rest of the division went up through there. Incidentally, by this time, the two reserve companies had actually got into Anholt itself, and taken the village, capturing about 60 prisoners.
Were you surprised at the degree of German determination at such a
place? Very surprised. I think it took everybody by surprise. And in fact, it was a German battle group. And one of the interesting things was that it was a mixed bag. There was some German armour, in fact, about 5 German tanks altogether. They were supported by artillery, and some of the dead that we counted, about 50 dead in front of our position. I found it extraordinary when I was examining the German dead, what a variety of units they came from. For example, there were Luftwaffe ground troops, there were Waffen-SS, there were conventional Wehrmacht troops, and their ages seemed to range from 15 to 50. And yet they were a battle group. They had been formed from all these different varieties of units because their regimental systems had been broken down in the campaign. In spite of that, they had an ability to dwell together, and a battle group which consisted of about 1,000 men from a variety of units was quite a formidable force. And like a battle group was, in my experience, like a scorpion, it had a nasty sting in the tail. I know, I've experienced both.
What happened to you on V-Day?
I got drunk.
Whereabouts was this?
Hmm?
Whereabouts was this?
I had just got back to my unit in Germany, having been wounded for a second time, when I was doing a job on the left flank of the battalion going up towards Minden. I was given the carrier platoon under my command to prove some firebreak areas in the middle of a pine forest in case there was likely to be a German counterattack on the single road which the whole of the 43rd Division had to use as its axis of advance. During this process, the 3rd Carrier, which was allotted to me, the carrier platoon was allotted to me by the colonel, although he took away my much-valued troop of tanks from me. The 3rd Carrier that went up one of these rides struck a mine and blew up and killed the crew. And a piece of, I don't know whether it was wood or metal, was sticking up behind, and the carrier platoon sergeant walked towards it. I suddenly knew what he was going to do, and I said, "No, don't touch it." But too late, he pulled it out, blew himself to smithereens, and blew a large hole in the right side of my face and my right ear, which I then came back to East Grinstead and had a bit of surgery and got my ear replaced from the right buttock of my bum, and then went back quite soon to Germany, and I was back with my regiment on VE Day.
Who treated you at East Grinstead?
McIndoe, you know, the rather famous surgeon.
Can you tell me any details about your time under McIndoe?
Not really. Most of the other chaps were much more seriously injured than I had been. They nearly all of them were RAF chaps who had bad facial burns. Sometimes they look quite grotesque, and part of their sort of rehabilitation was to accept the fact that they weren't looking quite as normal as they had before, but they were still vibrant and active human beings. And I suppose a great deal of the treatment was mental rather than medical, in that it restored the confidence of these chaps, and it was rather a splendid thing to see. But I wasn't there for very long.
How long were you in the East Grinstead Hospital?
Only about a fortnight, actually.
What personal impression did McIndoe create?
I can't recall, really. I mean, he was a fairly... He was a rather remote figure as far as I, as a humble patient, knew. I mean, I knew he operated on me, and he came and spoke to me, but we never became sort of mates or anything like that. So I really don't know. I can't describe him as a character that I knew well.
Did you have any problems adjusting mentally to your wound?
No, none at all. Once I knew that I wasn't going to be badly facially scarred, I was pretty happy.
How do you feel now about having served with the First Worcesters in the Second World War?
I feel great pride, actually. Because the Worcestershires became my regiment. I eventually commanded them. And a British regiment is rather like a very well-adjusted family. You really do know everybody who's in it. And I think this is perhaps one of the reasons why the British Armed Services, all three of them, are perhaps in many ways the envy of the world. We're not the most powerful, but I think we are perhaps the most professional still. In fact, I'm sure we are. And I think we are basically acknowledged as being such.
When I asked you about how you felt about having served with the First Worcesters in the Second World War, you talked just about the First Worcesters rather than the war itself.
Well, that is because during the war, I was basically totally with the First Worcesters, or initially the 11th Worcesters, which became the First Worcesters, as I have described to you.
But if I'd have asked you the question in a different way, if I had said to you, how do you feel about having served in the Second World War, what would you have said?
Something pretty similar, I think. I believe that all the British services conducted themselves with great distinction and considerable gallantry in that war, and I was very proud to be a humble cog in what I considered a magnificent military machine.
But did the political aspect of the war mean much to you?
Inasmuch that I believed that it was a necessary thing to destroy dictatorship and fascism and Nazism, and I thought that was a necessary and worthy aim to fight.
Now, after the Second World War, I think you had a period in the Malayan Emergency. Could you tell me how that came about, please?
Yes. My regiment in 1950 was posted to Malaya. Now, the Malayan Emergency, if I may digress for a moment, started as a result of a succession of incompetent and disastrous decisions made by British governments of various colours and persuasions, both Tory and Labour. And these were that the history of the Malayan Emergency was that in 1948? No. During the war, after about 2 years, the Japanese entered the war, starting, of course, at Pearl Harbor. They then actually attacked Malaya. And Malaya had been, at that time, a British colony. And it was not very well controlled by military forces. Now, that is not very well expressed. I will try better. The military strategy for Malaya had not been thought out properly by anyone. Neither had it been anticipated that the Japanese would attack Malaya. As a result was that if there was any threat to Malaya, it was calculated that it would come as a seaborne invasion towards Singapore from the South China Sea. In the event it didn't, the Japanese attacked Malaya from the northeastern end of the peninsula of Malaysia, of Malaya. They got bicycles and they went through jungle lanes on bicycles where no British military tactician had thought was a possible passage for an invading force. They eventually attacked Singapore from the north. All the guns in Singapore and its surrounding islands were facing south. So there was very little to prevent the Japanese from taking Malaya. At that time, two forces went into the jungle. One was Spencer Chapman, who was a British officer who had a force called 136. He described his adventures very lucidly in a book called The Jungle is Neutral. They endured a great deal by living in the jungle, and this small force harassed Japanese lines of communication, produced ambushes and so on. Another force also went into the jungle under a man called Chin Ping. Chin Ping was a university student and a tennis player of international ability. He was also a Marxist. He too went into the jungle, and he and Spencer Chapman combined in another number of operations. After the atom bombs dropped on Nicosia and Hiroshima and the Japanese surrender, the British administration returned to Malaya with its usual pompous colonial administration. Sorry, that was the word I wanted to put in. Chin Ping was invited to march in the Victory Parade in London, which he did, and was awarded an MBE. He was also told that because he had communist leanings, if he didn't conform to the standards that the British administration wanted, he would be in dead trouble. Chapman, who didn't do as much as him, was awarded a DSO. And I think Chin Ping was right in feeling that his MBE was a derogatory award compared to Chapman's DSO. Eventually, Chin Ping said thank you for nothing and took his Chinese force back into the jungle and harassed the newly created British administration in exactly the same way that he had originally harassed the Japanese occupational forces.
Poof. When and how did you go there?
I had been doing a staff job in Germany, and regular officers usually only do 3 years in a staff appointment and then have to go back to their units and do 3 years to get their boots dirty again, which is a very good idea in my opinion. And then they do another staff appointment. My battalion had been posted to Malaya, and at the completion of my staff appointment in Germany, I was reposted to the battalion in Malaya.
Do you know which year that you got there to Malaya? Well, it's in your book, but...
I think it was 1951.
Where were you posted in Malaya? Where was the battalion?
In Johor, in a place called Kluang.
And what job did you have with the unit then?
I was given A Company again as company commander.
Did you go out into the jungle with them?
Yes, indeed. But the first fortnight I was there, because I had no jungle experience, I told my platoon commanders that I would go out with them as an ordinary rifleman under their instruction, so that I would get a smell of the tactical area.
Did you like it on jungle patrols?
No, it was bloody uncomfortable.
In what way?
Well, if you like 100 leeches on your body in any one day, I suppose you would probably enjoy it. If you liked a particularly vicious thorn broom, a bush, which was known as wait a while, which caught up your equipment and held you back, and if you tried to sort of push your way through it, you tore yourself to smithereens. And while you were doing it, you were watching leeches looping along the thing to get a good meal on your own blood cells. You would have enjoyed that. So, you know, if you were a total mechanist, a total masochist, you would probably have had a bloody good time. But I wasn't.
How did your troops perform in the jungle then?
Well, I think they felt rather the same as me. Strangely enough, things grow on one. And eventually I got to quite like jungle operations. It wasn't too bad taking leeches off yourself.
What was the attraction of it then?
The jungle, the wildness of it, sometimes one would come across a tree and see great scratch marks on it and realize that a bear had been sharpening its claws on the tree. There were some beautiful orchids that grew in the jungle. There was a certain sort of stillness about it. There were three different types of jungle, two different types of jungle, really. There was a secondary jungle and primary jungle. Now, secondary jungle was where the ground had originally been cleared, and crops, usually tobacco or tapioca, had been grown, and then for some reason it had been allowed to return to its original state. And this was terribly difficult to go through because the vegetation was pretty close to the ground and very dense. Now, primary jungle was the old long established rainforest. Trees were about 200 feet high, and it was almost like walking through a cathedral close to go down through the jungle below them. You know, one was in almost semi-twilight all the time, and there was some, as I'm sure you can imagine, some attraction about this.
Can you describe any brushes with the enemy that you personally had in the jungle?
Yeah. In fact, one spent an enormous, frustrating amount of time in the jungle without making contact. But there were a number of reasons why this happened. Firstly, it was necessary to make contact with the Aborigine people who initially lived in the jungle. And secondly, to be able to provide them with medical supplies to cure them from illnesses and so on, which their poor standard of living had subjected them to. As a result of this, they started to trust us and give us information about the movements of the communist terrorists. Henceforth, I'll refer to them as CTs. Now, if you're going to have success in jungle warfare, you have to ambush. And if you're going to ambush, you have to have good information about the movements of the opposition. Otherwise, you'll be laying an ambush in an area that's not productive. The information about CT movements comes from the Aborigines who live in the area, who observe the CT movements. This gives one an